Now, when your bank balance reads $2.26, you get a bit of a fright. Well, it gave Grant Sabatier something else. It gave him motivation to make a million. He'd lost his job. He was living with his parents. And he decided this was not the life he wanted to live. So he made a bold pledge to save $1 million by the time he hit 30. He read more than 300 personal finance books. He worked up to 100 hours a week. And within 5 years, the bank balance showed 7 figures. He now writes a blog sharing the lessons he's learnt. It's called Millennial Money, and Grant is on the line with us now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to chat to you. Why did it take that shock, that sort of wake-up call of seeing your bank balance to turn you around?
Oh, I think it was a confluence of factors. One of the biggest realizations was because I'd actually, been out of college for about 3 years. So I'd been working for a while, and I did the calculation, and I traded 4,700 hours of my life for about $85,000 mm-hmm. after taxes, and I had nothing left. And I had hated, my previous jobs, and ended up back home at my parents, and really was staring out, into the next 40 years, and was basically like, oh man, I only have $2.26 left. I want to do this differently this time. And I didn't even know if that was possible. And so that's why it was rock bottom. My parents, they're loving parents, but they said, you can crash here for 3 months, but we're not going to give you a dime. So the pressure was on. I'd already been there for a couple of months, and really had to get my act together pretty quickly if I was going to make it happen.
Yeah, and you could have aimed lower, Grant. You could have said, well, I'm going to aim to move out of my parents' house, or even buy your own house, or pay off your student loan. But what was the significance of choosing that million-dollar target? And do you think that the high target was part of the secret to your success?
Yeah, I think it was, it was a pretty uneducated, pie in the sky number. It seemed really unrealistic to me at the time. A lot of people, it's just in popular culture. It's like, how can I make $1 million? How can I become a millionaire? It was kind of that naive in that sense that, okay, I'm going to try to make $1 million. When I set out to do it, I didn't know if it was possible, how I was going to do it, what it would take to make it happen. But, it was the best goal that I could ultimately come up with. And over time, interestingly, about a year and a half into really starting to make more money, I realized that I actually wasn't that far off from the amount of money that I would need to actually become financially independent. So I calculated that number would be $1.25 million would be, the money that I would need, with some consistent type of cash flow at some point through my life. But that would be enough money to make work optional and really for me to be able to retire if I wanted to.
Are the challenges that millennials face, the financial challenges, different to the challenges faced by previous generations?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of challenges. I think there's actually more opportunities than challenges. But I mean, the biggest one that you can't argue with is just the amount of debt, at least in the U.S., that students have to take on is a huge barrier. I mean, the average millennial graduates with about $36,000 in debt, so you're already in the hole before you're even getting started. I think we're also, at a period where, millennials have really been kind of underemployed. You actually look at the data, and a lot of incomes have stagnated, and most millennials make less, and in some cases 50% less when you actually match up the salaries than their parents did at their age. And so that's kind of crazy. It's the fact, so we're making less money, we have debt, and so the cards have really kind of been stacked against us. But I really think it's actually never been easier in history to make more money. I write a lot about this. We've got an asset that our parents didn't have, and that's the internet. And so, there's just ways to make money, more ways to make money than has ever been possible. I think the key is, you know, finding those ways and then being smart once you actually make the money. And that's really what I talk a lot about on my blog.
Yeah, there's a running joke here in New Zealand, I don't know if you have it in the States as well, about millennials wasting all their money on smashed avocado on toast. Is there some truth to that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's very clear, and you know, a vast majority of Americans and millennials generally, they spend their money on three things. You know, the three biggest expense categories are housing, transportation, and food. And we're definitely spending more money on food than we ever have before. In the U.S., there's just, you know, you can get literally anything delivered almost 24 hours a day. But there's a real premium associated with that. So, yeah, I think it comes, you know, certainly millennials really value food, and we spend a lot of money on it. I think that definitely rings true. But avocado toast is actually pretty inexpensive. You know, it probably only costs, you know, if you're going to make it yourself, a couple dollars here in the U.S.
Oh, yeah, but you go to a cafe, it's like 17, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. No, I mean, the problem we get into here is juice. Like, everyone's into juice.
Yeah.
And I was recently in New York, and I literally had a moral dilemma because there was this, I really wanted juice. I was super tired. I'd been traveling a lot. And, you know, juice is really good for your immune system. And I went in this juice store. It was like $16 for a juice. And I literally stood there. You know, I'm a millionaire, but I stood there for, you know, a good 10 minutes just staring at the sign, trying to compel myself to buy this juice. And I ended up giving in. I did buy the juice. And I think it was a good decision.
Hey, on your way to being a millionaire, you read all those books about money. More than 300 I read. So I read that you read more than 300. Did they help?
Oh, they totally helped. And it's actually, I'm in the middle of writing one now.
Great.
I'm writing one for, yeah, Penguin. And yeah, they certainly helped. I mean, probably the first, you know, 20 or 25 were pretty transformational to me. You know, I literally just went down the list and started, you know, reading the most seminal text, like, you know, Your Money or Your Life, Think and Grow Rich, and really moved down the list. But once I got past 25, you know, they start getting repetitive. So I'm kind of a personal finance book pro now. Mm. You know, now it's fun because I get them for free now. You know, publishers send them to
yeah.
me, and I can read them. I can read them in an hour or two because, you know, you always go past the compounding interest chapter.
Yeah.
And you go, you know, a lot of them are pretty formulaic in a sense. But, you know, I think, you know, I read over 300 personal finance and investing books. And when you add that investing component on, you know, it actually gets really interesting because there are a lot of really, really interesting investing strategies out there.
So let's do some building blocks. And by the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Grant Sabatier, who is a young millionaire. He decided to make a million, and he's got a blog called Millennial Money. So where did you start, and where do you suggest people start?
Oh, man, my favorite book of all time, hands down, is Your Money or Your Life. It's actually funny because, you know, in recommending the book now, I've become quite close to the author. Mm. She's kind of Vicky Robbins. She's the founder of the financial independence movement. She's in her mid-70s now. And it's the book that really established the premise, you know, for any amount of money that we're working for, we're trading our life energy for that money. And so whenever you're going to purchase something, instead of saying like, oh, you know, this is only $100 dinner, think about it in terms of how much of your life did you have to work and trade for that dinner. And when you start doing that type of a calculation and realizing that you're really making a trade-off with your energy whenever you buy something, you know, it can be pretty transformational. And I really encourage people, you know, definitely to read that book and to think about that idea, because you start to, you know, once you start really taking your time more seriously and you start valuing, you know, at the end of the day, you know, just having more free time or being able to do whatever you want, you know, you really start thinking twice about perhaps, you know, ordering that extra bottle of wine or, you know, eating that $17 avocado toast.
Yeah, because money's just numbers, right? And it's easy to abstract numbers from real life.
Yeah, totally. I mean, at the end of the day, it all comes down to what you value. So it goes back to my juice example. I was willing to pay, you know, over $15 for a juice just because I really valued it at that time. So it's not, You know, a lot of people think that personal finance, it's all about being frugal and, you know, putting away your pennies. You know, I tend to push against that a little bit. You know, at the end of the day, we all want to live, you know, meaningful, happy lives. And so, you know, money is a tool in that sense. And, you know, for me personally, I really wanted that juice. It added a lot of value to my life. And it was totally, totally worth the energy that I traded for it. So if you approach every purchase decision, you know, with, you know, how is this going to make my life better? You know, what am I going to get out of this? You know, it starts making, you know, the financial decisions become easier and easier. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, get caught up on trying to make a budget. I'm actually kind of anti-budget.
Really?
Because, you know, when you think about the dollars and cents and you're tracking every single penny, you know, it takes a lot of the joy out of it. And a lot of people sacrifice on the wrong things. Like moving to a smaller apartment is 10 times more effective than, you know, say cutting out your latte every morning.
Yeah, that's so true, isn't it?
It's your lattes that you love. Like I drink really nice coffee. I get coffee beans delivered from Oregon here in the US, and I pay a real premium for them, but I just really love coffee, and it's something that, you know, I get a lot of joy from. And I think a lot of people, when they try to, you know, get their finances in order, they start cutting those little things in their life that actually really make them really happy. And so the last thing you're going to want to do is save money when you're trying to cut back and you're really unhappy. So people create the budget, they get really excited, and then they just stop. And so I have this thing called the only budget you'll ever need, where it's basically, you know, move to a smaller apartment, sell your car, or downgrade your car and cook more at home. And just doing that, you can save, you know, 30-40% more of your income per year.
Because you're attacking, no matter how wasteful $3 a day on coffee sounds, you're actually spending a much greater bulk of your income on accommodation or transport, right? So it's much easier to cut back there than it is to cut back on a small expense like coffee.
Yeah, totally. Mm. Yeah, enjoy the coffee. I mean, it's every day. You know, enjoy it, you know, whereas maybe you can move to a smaller apartment, you know, or get a roommate. You know, that's super huge in the U.S., you know, everyone shacking up with their roommates or their friends, you know, to cut your cost down and then just invest the difference.
And yes, so that's the other way, of course, rather than cutting your expenses, to increase your income. And you recommend something called a side hustle.
Oh yeah, side hustling is, I don't know if it's big in New Zealand, but it's getting really popular here. You know, the simple idea is that, you know, outside of your job, get another job. A lot of people, you know, recommend it so you can have extra money to spend, but I've always been a big believer in side hustling to invest. So, you know, back in 2010, once I moved out of my parents' place, you know, I started doing a bunch of stuff like, you know, rebuilding mopeds and selling concert tickets and building websites. And every dollar that I made side hustling in 2010 is worth $3.50 today. Mm. So the future value of that side hustle money was huge. And so, yeah, side hustling is awesome. I mean, you know, I still, you know, I live in a condo in downtown Chicago. And so occasionally someone will, you know, put on the list host, they'll need a cat sitter or a dog sitter. And if I'm around for the weekend, I'll do it for the $60 or $80, you know, because I know the opportunity, you know, that money, just investing small amounts, will continue to grow.
Bonus money, eh?
Totally. I mean, everything. A lot of people just, you know, at the end of the day, if you wake up every morning and you think, how can I make an extra $20 or how can I make an extra $50 today? You know, and you go out and you start to seek out those opportunities, you know, they're there. And so that's one of the things is, sure, you have to make some trade-offs. But, you know, if you want to make extra money, in a lot of cases, you know, it's never been easier because of the internet. And just look around you. You know, there's always something to be done. Someone needs help in your neighborhood. And then you can bank that money for the future.
Yeah, okay. And where does that money go then? Where do we put it?
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in index fund investing, which is, you know, essentially investing in the entire U.S. equities market. So, you know, most stock pickers are terrible. And so if you invest in index funds, you know, you're already going to be beating 80 to 90%. You know, of the active stock pickers. I do invest in some individual equities from, you know, here and there, you know, like Amazon and Facebook and some of these tech companies. I only really invest in things that I use and that I know, you know, just things that I'm familiar with. But, you know, I only recommend that you take, you know, 10% or less of your investing portfolio and invested in individual equities. The rest of it should be in something, you know, like index funds, and definitely no day trading. That's the biggest question I get. You know, I have $3,000. What stock should I buy? You know, I'm looking to day trade, and it's like, no, terrible idea.
I don't know that term, day trade.
Day trade, it's just you're buying and selling stocks, you know, quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like a day trader. So it's like you might buy it and then sell it the next day,
okay,
you know, to make a profit.
But you get all those transaction costs, huh?
Yeah, or it's just like gambling. I mean, you never know. Over the long haul, you know, being a successful stock investor is you know, you need to think about, just like Warren Buffett, you need to think about like investing in stocks. You know, you're really investing in a company. And so if you ever buy a stock, you should really be thinking, okay, I need to hold on to this, you know, for at least the next, you know, 5+ years. You know, if you're not willing to hold on to a stock for that long, you know, there's better things to invest your money on. Because just trading, buying it one week and, you know, it goes up 10% and then selling it the next, yeah, the transactions or the taxes, you know, really erode a lot of the gains. And it's just, you know, you're gambling in a sense, because you never know what's going to happen with the company or the market. But if you stay consistently invested over a long period of time, you know, you're much, much more likely to have a positive net annual compounded return over, you know, any 10+ year period.
We have a housing shortage in New Zealand at the moment, and buying houses for millennials is, I mean, it's, well, we're the least affordable country in the world for buying a house at the moment. And really, millennials are looking like a lot of them becoming long-term, lifelong renters. And do you have a feeling on renting versus owning? Can you make financial headway when you're renting a place rather than paying off a mortgage?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, one of the things, you know, you just have to think creatively. And so, you know, maybe renting a 3-bedroom apartment and living with two of your friends, or in the U.S., it's a big trend. Even, you know, couples live together. And so you'll get, you know, a 2- or 3-bedroom apartment and you'll split it with another couple, you know, in cities like New York and San Francisco, just to cut the cost in half. You know, whatever you can do, whether it's moving to a smaller place or, you know, getting a roommate, you know, anything to cut the cost or split the cost can be really helpful. Another big thing, a lot of people here, you know, rent out their places on Airbnb and other home sharing services. So even when you rent an apartment, you can still rent it out on Airbnb. So you can get pretty creative. And then if you actually do have the ability to buy a home, you know, I have some friends in really expensive cities like San Francisco. They'll buy a home with their friends. And so, you know, I know two people, you know, two guys in their mid-20s, and they bought like a 3-bedroom apartment in San Francisco and then rented out the other room, and they're able to deduct, you know, the cost, you know, of the extra renter from their mortgage. And so, you know, if you're willing to get creative, you can definitely save money renting or buying a place that you maybe thought you couldn't afford by going in with your friends.
Yeah, tear up that sort of dream that you grew up with of buying a 3-bedroom house for you and your partner and raising children in it, and think, well, how can I get onto the ladder a little easier and maybe make some progress, and maybe in 5 years' time I can rethink the dream and maybe be in a better position to actually achieve it.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's easy to see that we're all becoming increasingly mobile in our lives. And so I think there's going to be a point in time where, you know, very few people will need to own property. You know, you'll rent for a time being, you know, when you're living somewhere, and then you'll, you know, people won't kind of homestead, you know, and then they'll travel and live somewhere else. So I think we're becoming increasingly mobile and flexible. As long as you're smart and you save that difference, you know, it can be a wise decision to be mobile.
When you reached your $1 million, was it as satisfying as you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, it actually was. It was kind of surreal. It was funny. I was trying to, once I got going, my goal was 5 years. It took me 5 years and 3 months. Mm. So I didn't make my goal, but definitely getting there. I was super happy. I interestingly is, you know, I got to $1 million, but I didn't actually save $1 million. So, you know, at least half of my net worth at that period of that $1 million was from investment gains. And that's one of the things a lot of people are like, oh, wow, you know, how did you, you know, make $1 million and then save it? You know, did you live on nothing? But in reality, I actually saved, I think, about $480,000. But over that period, over that 5 years, my investments grew to actually be worth $1 million.
And your timing was good too, right? You got into the stock market at the right time.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things, you know, and I'm writing about this in my book right now. You know, this was one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my life. And there was also a lot of luck. But, you know, like anything in life, you can only control the variables that you can control. And when it comes to money, you can actually control a lot of them. So, you know, in some cases, you can control, you know, how much you're making, how much you're spending, you know, what your savings rate is. You know, there's no greater driver than your savings rate. So, you know, in the U.S., even worldwide, you know, if you save, you know, for every 1% more that you can save, you know, when you're 25, you can retire up to 2 years earlier. So, you know, just saving, you know, 11% instead of 10% or 16% instead of 15%, it all helps. And the savings rate is actually the biggest driver, without a doubt. And that's something that, you know, you can control. You can't control, you know, things like the stock market returns and other things and inflation. But, you know, a lot of people just don't control the variables that they can control. When, you know, it comes to money, it's pretty hard to, you know, kind of do what I did and make $1 million in 5 years. Not nearly as hard to, you know, make $1 million in 30 years. And so the whole idea is, once you get your financial house in order and you get going, the key is, once you know that you're kind of on the right path, then it's about, how do I optimize this? And, you know, through little small tweaks, cut a year off here, 2 years off there. But, you know, there's tons and tons of books that are great out there if you want to, you know, retire in 30 to 40 years. The tough thing is trying to do it in less than 10.
And now that you've made your money, you're helping others with this blog called Millennial Money, with the book to come. And Grant Sabatier, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, this is a lot of fun. Really appreciate it. Yeah, hope all is well in New Zealand, and hope to make it out there one day. I've been to Australia, but I've never been to New Zealand, so I'll definitely look you up when I'm on the book tour.
Yeah, please do. Nice to chat to you.
Yeah, take care.